Hello and welcome to the latest Packaging Europe podcast. My name is Elisabeth Skura. So images of plastic waste littering beaches and oceans are omnipresent in the media and are a visible manifestation of the big plastic pollution problem the world faces. Efforts are being made across the world to address this major problem. And one organization that is working on tackling this problem is Prevented Ocean Plastic, which is supplied by Bantam Materials. They set out to deliver high-quality recycled plastics that has been collected from coastal areas most at risk from plastic pollution. I'm very pleased to have Rafi Shaya on this podcast with me today, who is the founder of Prevented Ocean Plastic. Together, we'll discuss the challenges of ocean plastics and plastic collection and recycling, recycled plastic demand, and much more. So yeah, welcome, Rafi. Thank you for being on the podcast today. I'm looking forward to a really exciting conversation.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk about this very important issue. We're going to go into to as much detail as we possibly can, and for me, it's always really interesting for us to be as credible as possible with all the difficult questions, and hopefully show a bit of thought leadership.
Absolutely, yes. Could you maybe start by introducing yourself to our listeners who may not be familiar with you and your work, and talk a bit more about what inspired you to found Prevented Ocean Plastic?
Sure. So my name is Rafi, and we started as essentially a supply and distribution business that would be focused on recycled materials about 15 years ago. And in so doing, we started to learn the fundamentals and the basics that you need to be a successful business. You know, so things that have to do with getting the price right, the quality right, the regulations right, just-in-time delivery, and everything that customers need to be able to engage in high-quality recycled flake and high quality recycled pellet into all sorts of applications. But in so doing, I had the good fortune of traveling to, you know, probably about 50 different recycling factories in 30 different countries or so. And I saw that actually the problem is enormous. A lot of the standards are not where they need to be. And really, there's a massive gap on collection and sortation. So about 5 years ago, we wanted to embark on a mission to create more value, tell the market the truth about where their plastic comes from. We want every single customer of ours and every single consumer of theirs to know where their plastic comes from. And then we want to make sure that we do this in a way that obviously hits environmental goals and hits social goals, but also fit for business. So it's repeatable and scalable and can happen in a big way. So our big thing now is that we've been doing infrastructure builds for collection and sortation. We're really interested in just transition. We're really interested in UN sustainability goals. So for us, we're building 25 high capacity collection centers in 25 coastal regions that need them by 2025. Many of them are already operational. For us, a collection center is a minimum of 100 tons per month. And then we have 5 aggregation centers in that plan that are 500 tons per month. So altogether, that's over 50,000 tons a year of high quality recycled plastics being collected in coastal regions that never had them before. And we're very excited about it.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you've obviously hinted at this already, but I wanted to dive a bit deeper into Prevented Ocean Plastic mission and the approach it takes to address this issue of plastic pollution in the ocean and also to prevent plastic waste from entering marine ecosystems. You mentioned some of the work you do, but maybe you could go in a little bit more detail there.
Absolutely. So thank you for that. So when we start to approach this problem, we really wanted to take a defined strategy. So our strategy is credibility first, thought leadership, and a positive emotional connection to the solution, especially at scale and especially repeatable. So for us, one of the things that we saw in the market were many thin claims that had to do with all sorts of elements that had to do with sustainability, ocean, and et cetera. And we took an approach that if you build something, if you create jobs, you know, if you clean something, then you're really doing it. And especially if it's countable, traceable, then you're really doing it. So for us, we opened up 4 years ago our Prevented Ocean Plastic Research Center so that we can dive into the core roots of the problem. We have PhDs on staff, which is very rare for a distribution business. And we created a program fundamentally based off of doing exactly what we say we're going to do and giving everybody the data and the information behind what it is that we do as the market requires it. It also creates a big quality advantage for anybody who's involved in recycled materials. They know that the quality is always volatile, but the core of what we do on a quality perspective, and we're able to do this at scale because we're the first ones to touch the bottles when it comes to collection and sortation, is we create 99%, for example, PET bottle bales with no cap and no label most of the time. We also create 99% HDPE bales, 99% PP bales. And when we start with a feedstock that is that strong, and you add on traceability, and you add on responsible sourcing, and you add on scalability and real volume, then we feel like you're doing the right thing. So we've been really happy to showcase this. We've been really happy to be supported by USAID. They've made multiple investments in this program and in our infrastructure builds. We're really happy to partner with Circulate Capital, which is a leading ocean plastic prevention investment house. And they've received their money from the top 10 FMCGs in the market. Everyone's visited our infrastructure builds. Everyone's seen what they are. We've been showcased. And we're so eager and happy to continue on this mission, essentially, to collect plastic before it gets into the water. And one of the reasons why that's so important is there's a lot of overreaching statements about the word ocean plastic. And we all know that once the plastic is in the water, the sun and the salt degrades that plastic and makes it largely unusable for recycling, especially at scale. So it's really a matter of prevention. So that's what we're trying to do. We want it to be something that everybody can touch and see and pull apart. Everything that we do is in our name. It's prevented ocean plastic. So we do not fish anything out of the water. This is prevention. And I was lucky enough to give a talk to an NHS audience this week. And it's the same thing with a hospital. It's what you do before the person gets into hospital, which is really, really important. So for us, the mission of prevention means that we're setting up collection centers in areas where it never existed before. Right now, we're building in island regions that never had formal collection and never had any recycling capacity ever before. So by developing that infrastructure build that could collect 100 tons a month or 500 tons a month before that plastic gets into the ocean, before it gets degraded by that sea salt and by that UV, then we've done a lot. But there's also another step, which is just good practice in recycling. And this comes from our supply chain expertise. At the recycling level, when that material is being pulled apart, when those 99% PET bottle bales are being pulled apart, it will go through a black conveyor belt and then it's going to be sorted for impurity. But then it's going to go through, and this is a tip to the industry, it's going to go through a white conveyor belt. And when it goes through that white conveyor belt and there's a light that shines on it, you see yellow bottles that have been degraded and you're able to separate those out as well. So you get fewer instances of yellowing and degraded bottles that make it into the recycling process.
Could you discuss some more of the technologies that you use to improve recycling and improve results?
Certainly. So all industry experts will know that it's very hard to find the machine that will do absolutely everything for you. So I'm in the UK where there's curbside collection. And with that mixed material stream and curbside collection, it's very hard to separate out that mixed material stream into perfect purities and perfect sortation, even with the best machinery in the market. So for us, what is really important is to have what everybody knows is required in this industry, a combination between top-end machinery, but also the human aspect and manual sortation. So for us, it's incredibly important that at the collection center level, where one of our advantages is that we do have a joint ownership over those collection centers, there's a great sortation happening there before baling. And then when those 99% PET bottle bales then make it to the recycling factory, they're broken apart, you go through another level of manual sortation before it hits the top end machinery. And, you know, we'll go through Tomra sorters. We have people who are using S plus S. We have people in our program who are using top-end European machinery throughout their system. We all know names once we get into deeper into the process. You know, a pelletizer could be an Arima pelletizer or a Stralinger pelletizer. But the thing is that what is the work you're doing on sortation before this plastic hits the top-end European or international machinery? And that is what really drives quality. And that's why when we're able to do, and excuse the jargon, NIAS analysis, we do a lot of data on the material we supply. So NIAS analysis is non-intentionally added substances. So for example, a lot of people in the market want to know is there any real risk of impurity in that material? And our non-intentionally added substances, our data outperforms almost any other material we found on the market. And it's not us saying it. The data says that, which has been conducted by independent European laboratories. And I would put our ability to get food safe compliance, our ability to provide a material that has RESI class behind it from certain recycling factories that we work with, our ability to be able to provide material that has pharma compliance, which is very hard to get in the industry, I would put it down to this aspect of collection and sortation being the real emphasis before it hits the top end technology.
Yeah, my next question, which I think you've kind of partly answered already with talking about your work processes, but obviously ocean plastics is a bit of a buzzword and I think is sometimes used by some companies for a bit of greenwashing. You just slap a logo on saying this is ocean plastics and it might not necessarily be that great in itself. How do you set yourself apart from that?
Let's go a little deeper into the topic. So this is my opinion, but it's a strong opinion. I believe that the word ocean plastic is an overreach of a statement. There's very, very few products out there, if any, at scale, that are really fishing large amounts of plastic out of the water and bringing them into higher applications. So I'm not saying that it's absolutely and completely impossible. I'm just saying that from all of our work, it's been hard to find instances where it's really functioning at scale in repeatable models and able to move. So what does work is, again, what we start to talk about is this topic of prevention. If we have proper collection, we can stop where plastic ends up. So one of the interesting things I like to talk about is that there's really only four places that plastic can go once it's been consumed. It could be recycled, it can go to landfill, it can go to incineration, or it can go to our oceans and our environment. Someone can challenge me and add a fifth, but I can't think of one. So we all know what the best option is. The best option is to capture that material and recycle it at scale. But very often what happens is that we refer to material as recycled, but what we actually do is ship it abroad, out of sight, out of mind to poorer nations, and then it ends up going into controlled or uncontrolled incineration. A big proportion of it ends up in landfill or in our oceans and our environment. So what we need to do is we need to start telling the consumer the truth. We need to start telling the consumer what we can recycle and what we can't recycle. We need to start telling the consumer exactly where something comes from. So on our side, especially evidenced by, you know, key players in our supply chain being able to have a RESI class, even though they're outside of Europe, we challenge the market whenever they deal with us to really find out where their plastic comes from. If you're buying virgin plastic, you're buying something that's made out of, you know, oil and petrochemicals, and that's what you're buying, and that is, you know, your decision, and that is an okay decision. When you're buying something that's made out of recycled plastic, you want to know that it comes from a source where it's been responsibly sourced, where people haven't been mistreated. You want to know that it's a fair and reasonable price. It's not overpriced, but you also want to know where that plastic originated. Within the recycling industry, there's so many intermediaries, especially at the beginning of the supply chain, where it's very hard for people to know who was that first person to touch the bottle, where did it go after that, where did it go after that, and where did it go after that before it got to the European manufacturer. And sometimes it goes through a supply chain that is not as open and as transparent and definitely doesn't have responsible sourcing at its core, such as the prevented ocean plastic.
Obviously, you talk about prevented ocean plastics, but I wanted to ask you also, there is obviously a big problem of massive amounts of virgin plastics ending up in the environment. Is it also a question of preventing plastics full stop or using less plastics? What are your thoughts on that?
So it's impossible to have any conversation about moving forward on sustainability without engaging with the topic of reduction. So we all know that there's a topic of reduction, and I know a lot of great people in the industry are doing great work on reduction. But at the same time, we also know that plastic is a wonderful material, and we also know that sometimes it should and needs to be used. So when we do use it, we need to use the best version of it. So we need to be able to say, well, a recycled material is a better choice often than something that would only be produced once, used once, and discarded. If we're able to get a circular economy to work, it's really not a supply issue. We focus on telling the consumer, put the right recycled materials in your recycling bins, but actually we need the market to demand that recycled material to come back into the supply chain. And if big businesses and big consumers don't generate that demand, then recycling will never work effectively. Now, there's big issues, not just in the PET market, but obviously big issues in polyolefins and in other plastics. And what we're really happy to say is, as thought leaders in the industry, PET is our core because it's the easiest to monetize. You know, these infrastructure builds are part of our core, but we're also really able to create an opportunity around HDP and PP, especially in non-food safe applications. And we're really able to execute impact investments that start to deal with the topic of low-value plastics. So there's all these other plastics that are making their way out into the environment that are so difficult to monetize, but we're challenging ourselves and our partners to deal with that. And we've been able to make some big inroads and get products on shelf, which really evidence that it's possible to do more than just PET. So in my particular opinion, yes, we can do more. It's a demand issue. It's not a supply issue. If the manufacturers out there, the big businesses out there, the governments out there encourage the use of recycled plastic and actually buy it, then all the micro entrepreneurs in the supply chain, all the business owners in the supply chain, they will source it, they will collect it, they will sort it, they will recycle it, and they will provide it. But right now, it is a demand issue more than a supply issue.
Yes, that was going to be my next question. Have you noticed that more brands are willing to use recycled plastics? Because it seemed to me that it was still virgin plastics was still more popular because, well, simply because it's cheaper and easier. Have you noticed a shift there? And do you think that that might continue to shift in that direction?
Well, there is a shift. I think 10 years ago, prevented ocean plastic would have had a much more difficult time getting off the ground than today. I do think that there's a difference. So we're celebrating now a few big milestones. We're celebrating 50,000 tons of fully traceable material prevented from these at-risk coastal areas over the course of the last 4 years. So we would have never been able to hit that scale 10 years ago. Now, is it perfect today? Is demand perfect? Definitely not, but it is improving. So government regulation is helping. Big business decision-making is improving when it comes to sustainability. I've seen one manufacturer even make their procurement department report to their sustainability department. And I found that a really interesting change on the corporate level where, you know, sometimes sustainability could be an afterthought, very much below price. Whereas there's a company or two out there have decided to say, well, actually, you can't get this procurement decision through unless the sustainability department signs off on it. And I think that that is a very interesting approach for the market. I think that will be hopefully something to be repeated. I think it's important for us to dig into the numbers and for us to be really detailed in what we're saying. So obviously, there's different countries that have the plastic packaging tax coming through. And there are many companies that are deciding to pay the tax as opposed to changing their behavior and use recycled plastics because it's cheaper to pay the tax. But let's dive into those numbers for a moment. Very often, when you're looking at a procurement manager's decision-making, they're trying to save their company 4% of their buy, 8% of their buy, whatever their target is. And when something's just fractionally more expensive, it gets kind of set aside because it doesn't help people make their short-term obligations, their year-end obligations. But when you look at this on a per unit cost, when companies are producing billions of units, and we understand that essentially one shipping container can create 1 million units of a plastic bottle. When we see what the price difference is on a per bottle or per strawberry punnet basis, often it's a fraction of a penny. Often it's as low as 1/10 of a penny. 1/10 of a penny is 1/1,000th of the cost of a 1 euro item, of a 1 pound sterling item. And I can't buy a fizzy drink for 1 pound anymore. They cost 2.50, you know? So when we start looking at this and we go, well, we're talking about a fraction of a penny, dot two of a cent, dot 1.5 of a cent, then we start saying, well, look at this. You know, we all see the stats, less than 10% of, you know, plastic gets recycled. Maybe those stats are starting to change a little bit now and come up. But as a world, we're making the wrong decision 9 times out of 10, for a fraction of a penny on a fizzy drink or a home cleaning product or personal care item. I don't think there's anybody on planet Earth that would say, well, plastic should not be collected, social and coastal communities should not be supported, and animals should be ingesting material that leaks into our oceans and our environment for a fraction of a penny on a common household item. I just don't think it makes sense. And we need our bigger minds to be able to reach to a point or realize that very short-term thinking, very minuscule amounts of greed, they shouldn't determine where we go as an industry.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important message to get out there. So totally agree with that. I wanted to get back a little bit to the work of Prevented Ocean Plastic. And I saw that it was recently announced that you prevented 2.5 billion plastic bottles from entering the ocean. I was wondering, how do you generally quantify and measure the impact you're making and of the work you do?
Thank you so much for the question. So I'm really happy. Prevented Ocean Plastic is the flagship program of our company, Bantam Materials. So we only count what's real and what is true. There's no offset. There's no special calculations. It's a bottle that's been collected and that has been converted into a new product that was sold on shelves with full and complete traceability. So Prevented Ocean Plastic has absolutely surpassed that number. We'll dive into our approach in a moment. And Bantam Materials, when it comes to our full recycling and everything that we do that's not coming from coastal regions, we've already done 4, 5, 6 times that number as well. So we're really excited about our overall totals as well. We're really happy to be a big industry player on this topic. So in the industry, every now and then, there's conversations around mass balance, and there's conversations about a segregated approach, which is essentially a full documented chain of custody where you have one unit in, one unit out, and everything can be counted. So as a company, we don't like mass balance for our personal purposes. I understand there might be, you know, industries out there where it's a little bit more complicated than what we're doing, and mass balance is a requirement. But for what we do, we take a segregated approach, which means that we will count every bale that's produced, every, you know, shipping container of recycled material that's generated, every delivery that goes out to the customer. We count our yield loss, we count our tonnages, and we make sure that everything matches up. And I'm really proud to say that that's been tested, and that segregated model has been tested many times in the industry. So for example, we're very happy to supply little supermarkets. They're a major discount retailer, which shows that obviously a good quality material that's responsibly sourced with traceability can meet cost and scale. And Lidl did a television campaign and a billboard campaign promoting Prevented Ocean Plastic. Before they got to that step, they wanted to verify their bottle count. They want to verify their figures. They want to see everything. And I'm really proud to say that pretty much within 24 to 48 hours, we had all the documentation, all about the segregation model, all about all the loads that went through our system. You know, we cooperated with our manufacturing partner on the European side that was then supplying Lidl as a retailer. And we aligned from what I find so unique in the market, the collection center owner through to the recycler, through to the distribution chain, through to the European manufacturer. We could all sit in a room together and talk to each other, line up our books, and get to a point where a major retailer can make a television commercial proudly saying where their plastic comes from.
I wanted to ask you, sort of looking to the future, what are Prevented Ocean Plastic's long-term goals and strategies for maybe collecting even more and or tackle the challenge of ocean plastics altogether?
Well, thank you so much. So when we're looking at this, we're really looking at a few things. So short-term and the long-term, we really believe in the idea of better choices. It's really thematic for us. We really want to be a better plastic choice for the industry. And we're so happy to be the choice of, for example, the NHS for some of the health kits that get mailed out to everybody in the UK. We're a choice for responsible sourcing for Patagonia into their climbing shorts. We're a choice that goes into Lidl for cost and scale. We even supply, believe it or not, Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy into their 100% wine bottles that are made out of the rosé wine bottles. They're made out of plastic. So it shows that recycling can be a better choice for luxury. Recycling can be a better choice for cost and scale. Recycling can be a better choice for responsible sourcing. Recycling can be a better choice for compliance and hygiene. We can never meet the requirements of the NHS if we weren't compliant and we weren't hygienic. Also, when people make a better choice with what they do, they often win awards. So we're really happy to be working with the Hana Sushi Group, the largest purveyor of sushi, from the best of my knowledge, across UK and Europe. And when they pulled out their kind of black bottom tray, replaced it with a clear prevented ocean plastic on the bottom and the top, stamped the top and the bottom, they got Sustainable Brand of the Year. So short term, being a better choice for the industry is really valuable for us. Long term, which is what your question was, is we are a for-profit business. We are very proud to be a for-profit business. We are not a not-for-profit. And what that means is that we've been able to make this scalable, repeatable, and make this something that can really grow. And in this, we really believe in a value for stakeholders approach, where, you know, everybody in the supply chain is making a good and decent margin. Sometimes the margins are at the front of the supply chain with the brand owners. And what we actually want is to get to a point where there's a strong value chain where all stakeholders are benefited. I don't look at this going, well, over the course of the next 15 years, I just want to make my pile of money bigger. What I would like to do, which is really interesting, is pass a personal test. On a day, did I do more good than I did harm? And if on that particular day I did more good than I did harm, and I'm able to feed my family, and I'm able to travel and have an interesting life, I'm super happy. And then on a business level, 15 years from now, we want this just transition model of prevented ocean plastic to then build infrastructure in almost every coastal region that we can find. And what I mean by that is that this is repeatable, scalable. It's essentially a franchise model. Find me a coastal region anywhere that doesn't need to be a little bit cleaner, doesn't need better infrastructure, and doesn't need more jobs. We've now proven that it can be profitable. We've proven that it can work. And what I would like to see is our 25 by 2025 mission grow to a few hundred by 2030, and maybe a few thousand there and beyond. Why can't we be like Starbucks, be like McDonald's, where people are collecting plastic and doing something good for the environment and have that grow as a true and real franchise model? I will be so personally happy if 15 years from now, almost anywhere I go on holiday, almost any beautiful region that I ever am able to go, I know I'm not so far from a place where we created a job, we made things a bit cleaner, and we built up some infrastructure that's desperately needed. And if we got that to supply into some of our great brand partnerships, that is even better. I'm so happy to announce that and they made a public announcement a couple of days ago at one of the conferences, where if you currently walk into a Lush store, you will see a logo on all of Lush products that say "Prevented Ocean Plastic." They went deep into our supply chain. They were really eager to see what it is that we were doing. They scratched the surface. They challenged us. And that's, you know, a big brand, and they've decided to put our logo on the front of their pack, and we couldn't be more proud. We couldn't be more proud of that on the brands. On the grassroots side, we need to do our job, but we need to do it properly. On the supply chain side, we got to hit our quality. On our supply chain side, we got to hit all of our marks on pricing just in time, and then we can really make sure that we get some of these successes on the brands.
Sounds great. And my last question to wrap up this podcast was kind of feeds from what you said in your previous questions. In a perfect world, in 10, 20, however many years, what do you think is needed to really fully tackle this challenge of ocean plastics, or generally a plastic waste anywhere? I mean, it's a problem in the ocean, but it's a problem everywhere. What do you think is needed to really get a grip on this all around the world?
I think the big gap in the market is on the collection and sortation side. I think we need infrastructure to collect and sort properly. And then what I think we truly need to solve this problem is demand. I think that we can solve this problem tomorrow or 3 years from now or 10 years from now, when all the big businesses in the world understand, and all the consumers in the world understand, that if we put 10 units of something into the world, and we only buy back one of those units, 10% for recycling, that recycling will never work. What we need to do to make this industry work, what we need to do to go out and clean and build and do better, is the demand that when we produce 10 units, that we can get a substantial amount of those 10 units demanded back into the market, and then we let all the good and smart people with proper coaching, a proper model, a proper skill set go out there and collect that and generate small businesses for themselves and generate the economic activity for themselves. But none of that happens without demand. So the consumer, when they go into the supermarket and they have a choice and they see, for example, a piece of fish and it's in a piece of plastic that is in a recycled piece of plastic, it's made from recycled, where it says perhaps prevented ocean plastic on it, they decide to choose that and they create customer demand, they create market share, and they show the big businesses that they need to change their behavior to keep up with what the world wants. I think that if we overprice to the consumer can't make that choice. I made a comment earlier that the choosing recycled is a fractional cost increase. It wouldn't make sense to double the price of your product, to make your product 1.5 times the price if you've taken on a fractional cost in its creation. So if we can price to the consumer in a way where they can then allow themselves to make that better choice, where they can create demand, and then on the collection and sortation side, we can build up that infrastructure because those businesses will be profitable, I think that we can do a lot of good and we can really solve this problem.
Yes, and I think that's a very important message to get out there as well. Thank you very much for being here today and sharing your insights with me, Rafi. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for everybody within your team and your group, the events team, everybody writing. Been fantastic. And also you gathered together some wonderful minds that really are trying to bring the industry forward. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. That's great to hear. To our audience, thank you very much for listening. And please make sure you subscribe in your favorite listening app so you don't miss out on any of our latest episodes. Packaging Europe podcast is now coming out weekly, so lots more for you to listen to. And of course, if you're interested in packaging sustainability, make sure not to miss Packaging Europe Sustainable Packaging Summit, which takes place in Amsterdam on November 12th and 13th this year. For more information and tickets, head to our website at packagingeurope.com.